The legislation that I've authored is the Stop Shelter Evictions Act. This mayor has demanded an arbitrary, accrual cap on how many days asylum seekers can stay at a shelter. And what we're witnessing as a result of this counterproductive, again, there's no precedent as to why 30 and why 60 days. 30 days would be for adults, single adults, and 60 days for families with children. And New Yorkers are experiencing now the uptick in street homelessness, many more people in our subways, and also school-age children. 1,000 school-age children have been reported to leave the public school system as a result of these evictions. So my bill would reverse this counterproductive policy.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. We'll continue to follow that bill. Shahana Hanif is New York City Council Member, co-chair of the Progressive Caucus and the Task Force to Combat Hate. She's the first Bangladeshi American New York City Council Member. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Affecting our lives, and what can we do about it? We'll connect the dots, from energy to extreme weather, public health, and more. I'm Dr. Anthony Leiserwitz. Join me for Climate Connections during the evening news, weekdays at 5 p.m. here on 90.7 KBOO Portland.
The flowers are blooming, the birds are singing, and KBOO's spring membership drive is back. If you enjoy alternative radio that pushes the status quo, then support KBOO by becoming a member today. Donate online at bit.ly/KBOO or text KBOO to 44321 between now and May 25th and support Avant-Garde Airwaves.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO. In accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934, and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's Board of Directors meeting will be held on Monday, May 20th at 6 p.m. The meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from the League of Women Voters of Portland, providing nonpartisan election information at lwvpdx.org. The League of Women Voters has online voters' guides, videos, and podcasts to help voters understand the state and local candidates and measures that will be on the ballot this May. Nonpartisan voter information at lwvpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this Spring Membership Drive edition, KBOO Evening News. New documents reveal Zenith Energy met with a state DEQ in private before submitting their permit.
Prescription drug shortages leave patients with few options.
And Oregon practices for emergency evacuations on the coast in the event of a serious earthquake.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 13th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to bit.ly/KBOO. I'm Ezra.
And I'm Nina Mayfair. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, or DEQ, met with Zenith Energy in private ahead of its permit application, according to a new investigation by DSMOG. Zenith Energy is the oil-by-rail company that was nearly chased out of Portland by locals and city officials because of the environmental and health risks their work posed to the city. That is, until officials abruptly changed course, granting new permission for Zenith to expand its operations. Street Roots and DSmog reported last year that Zenith courted two city commissioners and their staff behind closed doors, away from public scrutiny, in the summer of 2022. Now, it seems state agencies responsible for overseeing part of the permitting process also met with Zenith privately before their application was submitted. In July, DEQ met with Portland officials from multiple bureaus discussing a possible new land use permit for Zenith. This was while the city of Portland was in a lawsuit against Zenith to prevent them from expanding their oil-by-rail terminal. A month and a half later, DEQ officials met with a representative from Zenith and their law firm. Handwritten notes from the meeting seemed to refer to what DEQ would do when the land use permit was okayed by the city. That included a line saying they would, quote, work together to process expeditiously, end quote, potentially in reference to the air permit Zenith needed from them.
DEQ, for their part, says that was just what Zenith needed, not what they agreed to. There's another part of the notes that reads, quote, attorney communications, city/DEQ/Zenith alignment before submittal. For opponents, this adds to their belief that the city and state process for approving the application was a foregone conclusion. It was already decided before it began. The DEQ says they will meet with people ahead of time on an application process to help with questions, but they didn't respond to a question from DSmog about whether they've done that with other oil companies who were in litigation with local governments like Zenith. Kate Murphy is a senior organizer at Columbia Riverkeeper. Murphy said, quote, it's highly concerning that the city and DEQ are making this level of effort to assist Zenith in getting this, particularly given the massive public opposition and the fact that they're doing this behind closed doors without any public input, end quote. A coalition of environmental groups are petitioning the Oregon Environmental Quality Commission to declare that Portland's approval of Zenith's permit wasn't sufficient. They want the commission to either throw out the permit or send it back for a do-over. They'll decide at a public meeting on May 23rd.
Supply chain disruptions mean consumers who need prescriptions filled are running into roadblocks. Parents and caregivers have limited options as the availability of generic medications is running low. There are several causes. Inoperable manufacturing plants cause production delays and back orders pile up. A key pharmaceutical ingredient needed to make a certain medicine has been discontinued, causing additional problems. Veronica Vernon is the assistant professor of pharmacy practice at Butler University. She calls the situation dire.
We're seeing one of the worst cases of prescription drug shortages that we've seen in recent years, unfortunately. This is a cause of concern because you go to the pharmacy and expect them to have the medication in stock, and they don't.
Vernon says pharmacists cannot guarantee patients when a certain medication will be delivered. She advises parents and caregivers to schedule refills up to 2 weeks in advance to make sure they'll be ready on time, if the pharmacy can even get the medication. The shortages affect both brand name and generic drugs. Vernon suggests keeping good lines of communication open with your pharmacist, and asking if there are any negative health risks tied to taking a generic if one is available.
One of the most important things you can do is to always keep a list of your current medications with you and also keep a record of what you've tried in the past. When my patients experience a shortage, I'll say, let's try this other medication that's in the same class that's expected to have the same effect. Have you tried that before?
Statistica.com estimates the total market for generic drugs worldwide was estimated at $412 billion in 2022. That figure is expected to increase to more than $600 billion by 2030.
There's a little over a week until Oregonians' primary ballots are due. So far, the voter turnout is lower than in previous elections. About 7% of the 3 million registered voters have sent their ballots back so far. It's not just the presidential primary that's on the ballot. Important state and local primaries and measures are on the ballot, too. Some experts say that the lower turnout than normal in Multnomah County could be because of the new ranked choice voting system for Portland city leaders, which will see over 60 candidates on the ballot in November. Ballots need to be postmarked by May 21st or dropped in an official drop box by 8 p.m. that day.
This week will be the largest ever Cascadia earthquake drill held on the Oregon coast. Emergency management personnel from around the state are meeting in Lincoln County for the exercise to practice how to respond to a catastrophic Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. The two-day exercise starts on Tuesday. Volunteers and first responders will practice creating an evacuation point at the Newport Airport. Rescue helicopters will make demonstrations as well. These sorts of efforts date back to 2016 with the multi-state Cascadia Rising exercise. Since then, there's been a push to establish more preparations. That includes setting up more evacuation assembly points like the one in Newport this week. The first one in Oregon was set up at the Tillamook Airport last year, and another is planned for the South Coast later this summer. Scientists predict there is a 37% chance that a major earthquake happens on the Cascadia subduction zone in the next 50 years. It's located off the coast of Oregon and would majorly impact the western part of the state, and the coast would see a tsunami form and crash into land.
The managers at the Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission who used insider knowledge to buy hard-to-find whiskeys won't face any criminal charges. That's according to the State Department of Justice. They investigated for 11 months to find enough evidence to charge these OLCC staffers with official misconduct. The scandal rocked the Liquor Control Board in early 2023. Certain liquors are only available in small numbers, and OLCC runs a lottery for the right to purchase them. Six employees at the OLCC were ultimately fired by Governor Tina Kotek for diverting some of those bottles to their own purchase. The Justice Department's report acknowledged that rerouting some of the liquor bottles to employees was a long-standing practice, but they weren't able to find out more about which specific employees benefited. Now that the Department of Justice won't charge the OLCC employees who were fired for the scheme, the Oregon Ethics Commission investigation will take over. It had been on pause while criminal charges were being investigated.
In a post-pandemic world, guaranteed income programs, where local governments and other entities give monthly cash payments to low-income households, have gained steam. New findings detail how these efforts are helping those who are disadvantaged achieve economic stability. Mike Moen has more in Madison.
Wisconsin is among the states where guaranteed income programs have been tested. A new report says that despite controversy, similar efforts are useful in helping struggling households land on firmer financial ground. The city of Madison gained attention for a program that ran from 2022 to 2023, where eligible households received $500 in monthly payments. Elsewhere in the U.S., the nonprofit Up Together has helped cities facilitate payments that come with no strings attached. The group's Rachel Barnhart says last year they helped 26,000 families access $18 million in unrestricted cash. Based on their outreach, all of it was spent on basic necessities.
Like housing, food, utilities, transportation, child care.
She says respondents note the assistance has improved their mental well-being while allowing some to enroll their kids in after-school activities. There has been pushback, with skeptics arguing these programs discourage people from working. Even though Madison's effort was privately funded, Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin sought to prohibit taxpayer funding of these initiatives. The bill was vetoed. Barnhart says in addition to their own surveys, her group is working with researchers to convey the effectiveness of this aid amid some of the resistance. She says a key example from Texas shows how important the payments are during an escalating housing crisis.
What the Urban Institute found in Austin was a majority of the cash payments was spent on housing, and we saw an increase in housing stability.
She suggests a growing patchwork of these payments would serve as a shield against evictions as tenants struggle with skyrocketing rents. There are longstanding forms of cash assistance, like the Federal Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, but those come with more requirements, and Barnhart argues there's an uneven approach among states to distribute the aid to recipients. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
A bipartisan move to stop stock trading by members of Congress stalls. Several of Trump's potential VPs refuse to say they'll accept any election results. And a Virginia school board restores the names of Confederate leaders to schools. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Americans are frustrated with Congress because too many members are personally trading stock and because there are more lobbyists around here than legislators.
California Democrat Ro Khanna says Congress is the wrong place to make a killing in the markets. A bipartisan group in the House says they're frustrated by all recent speakers' refusals to bring a bill banning members from trading stocks to a vote. While specific evidence of insider trading is rare, lawmakers' returns are unreasonably high, and analysts say a fifth of members own stock in industries they regulate. A Biden administration report says Israel's use of American-made weapons in Gaza likely violated international civilian protection laws. But it also says wartime conditions make it difficult to link specific weapons to specific attacks. New York Democrat Gregory Meeks says he supports President Joe Biden's decision to put a pause on some weapon shipments.
You can't go after 10, 20, or a brigade of Hamas and kill thousands of innocent people. There's got to be a better way of doing it.
Meanwhile, some House Republicans say they're drawing up articles of impeachment against the president over the weapons hold. South Carolina's Nancy Mace says she's not sure when a vote would take place, but that Biden's policies won't bring an end to the war.
This fight in the Middle East, this is about good versus evil, and Joe Biden needs to pick a side.
Several of former President Donald Trump's potential running mates are refusing to say if they'll accept the outcome of this year's election. South Carolina Senator Tim Scott and New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik have dodged the question, pointing to what they call irregularities in 2020. Ohio Senator J.D. Vance says he could support disputing the results this time.
If you think there were problems, you have to be willing to pursue those problems and try to prosecute case. And certainly, if we have a free and fair election, I'll accept the results.
Vance previously said he would have helped Trump overturn the 2020 election by voting for slates of fake electors when the Senate certified the winning president. Congress has since updated the Electoral Count Act to clarify that the vice president can't choose who to certify. A Virginia school board has voted to restore the names of Confederate military leaders to two local schools, 4 years after they were removed in response to the Black Lives Matter movement. The Shenandoah County board members say popular sentiment and due process were not considered when the names were changed. Eighth grade student Aaliyah Ogle says she wouldn't be proud to graduate from a school named after Stonewall Jackson.
That makes me feel like I'm disrespecting my ancestors and going against what my family and I believe, which is that we should all be treated equally and that slavery was cruel and an awful thing.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to a Spring Membership Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $60,000 by May 25th. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program or by going online to bit.ly/KBOO. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on at 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, LTAR. Let's talk about race. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear with some clouds and an overnight low of 51 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 75. Today in history, in 1862 during the American Civil War, the USS Planter, a steamer and gunship, steals through Confederate lines and is passed to the Union by a Southern slave, Robert Smalls, who was later officially appointed as captain of the vessel, becoming the first black man to command a U.S. ship. The quote of the day is from American author Philip Wiley, who said, quote, Ignorance is not bliss, it is oblivion. Determined ignorance is the hastiest kind of oblivion.
The Native American Food Sovereignty Alliance has a new leader, Ted Wright. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. Native American Food Sovereignty Alliance recently announced the appointment of Ted Wright as its new executive director. Wright has brought over 25 years of extensive leadership experience within tribal organizations and educational institutions, and has previously held numerous executive roles, including his service as the executive director for the Native Village of Eyak and Spokane Tribe of Indians, among others. In a statement, Chair of NAFSA's Leadership Council, Daniel Cornelius, said, quote, "Ted is uniquely qualified to lead NAFSA in this pivotal time. His deep understanding of tribal sovereignty and his proactive approach to leadership will be invaluable as we move forward with our mission to empower tribal communities through enhanced food sovereignty," end quote. Wright's immediate focus as executive director will be to guide NAFSA through its next phase of strategic initiatives, which includes stabilizing and deepening the understanding of its mission and increasing the impact on tribal communities. Wright said in a statement, quote, "I am honored to join NAFSA and contribute to an organization that is doing such critical work for food sovereignty. I look forward to working with our communities to fortify our food systems and ensure that our tribal nations can flourish for generations to come," end quote. Plans for his leadership include significant recruitment efforts for new board members and organizing impactful in-person meetings scheduled for the upcoming summer and fall. The Mashantucket Peacock Museum and Research Center in Connecticut has reopened after construction. The museum's organizers say it uses westernized museum practices and indigenized them. KMBA's Hannah Bissett has more.
The Mashantucket Peacock Museum opened its doors on August 11, 1998. It's tribally owned and operated, and according to the museum, it's the largest native-owned museum in the world. The museum covers around 20,000 years of history. The head of education for the museum is Nakai Clearwater Northrup, spoke about the new improvements and the mission of the museum.
Typically, the losers of the wars don't get to tell their stories. Other people get to write their histories for them, and we get to really combat that.
Originally, the renovations were architectural.
We've redone seating in our auditoriums. We have a 320-seat auditorium where we run larger programs.
The museum was also able to improve in other ways.
Revamped our witness film, which talks about the Pequot War. And if you came and saw it in the past 25 years, it was really grainy and it was literally actually running on film. So we've had it digitized and it's clear, it looks great.
Northrup says that the museum is also taking the renovations as a time to focus on repatriation and revitalization of language.
People would donate a lot of things, or they would just come and bring it here, and we'd house it here. And we're looking at a lot of these things now, and like, well, we really shouldn't have this, and we have the ability to return and repatriate items back to communities.
Northrup says repatriation falls under their four values: trust, relationship, balance, and decolonization. Continuing their mission, Northrup says that decolonization within museum science practices is significant for them, from the ways visitors can interact with exhibits to other traditions.
And just how we start the day, we're able to participate in ceremony. We have our family, tribal community here, hosting events.
This decolonization also takes the form of farmers markets, powwows, and other community-led educational programs. Along with this, Northrup and the renovations opened up the pathway for youth to learn more about the museum and what it has to offer.
To have the next generation here being able to come soak up information, and for us to have the awesome opportunity to continue to share our story and our history.
I'm Hannah Bissett.
And I'm Jill Freitas.
A new study finds the flame retardants used in the seats of many cars emit toxic gases and recommends the federal government reevaluate its flammability standards. Researchers at Duke University and the Green Science Policy Institute in Berkeley studied the air and foam from 101 car models, year 2015 and newer, and found traces of two carcinogens on California's Prop 65 list of harmful chemicals. Robert Harrell with the Consumer Federation of California calls on the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration or state officials to act.
We would hope that the relevant federal authorities would take a look at this
They have indicated that they're aware of this study. They're reviewing it. In some cases, California chooses not to wait necessarily for the feds to act, and we can try to act ahead of that.
The Alliance for Automotive Innovation, a trade group of dozens of auto manufacturers, did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The study in the journal Environmental Science of Technology found the chemicals are released into the air 2 to 5 times more often in the summer when the car is hot. It recommends people park in the shade, air out the cars before getting in, and avoid using the recirculated air feature in their vehicles. Harrell says his group fought to get the government to require the furniture manufacturers to phase out similar flame retardants.
Historically, the auto industry has really lagged behind on safety and consumer protection issues. More often than not, they've been sort of dragged, kicking and screaming into the modern age.
The flame retardants at issue don't prevent burning, but they slow a fire's progression. Many fires that start inside a car begin with a dropped cigarette, so some experts have suggested the feds update flammability standards with a new anti-smoldering requirement that could be met without the use of these types of chemicals.
Clean energy development is growing by leaps and bounds across the Midwest. However, a lingering question remains. Where can all these sources find room on a crowded power grid? As Mike Moen reports, advocates hope complementary solutions help the movement stay on a steady course.
A federal agency is announcing reforms related to the power grid, which is stretched thin as the U.S. transitions away from fossil fuels. It's a complex issue clean energy advocates in the Midwest know far too well. There's a push to expand transmission lines to accommodate the tidal wave of wind, solar, and other renewable projects. The new rules could address the thorny issue of cost-sharing among states for the build-out. More broadly, the Midwest Renewable Energy Association's Nick Heidla says market dynamics are tricky, noting competing interests among utilities and developers in expanding the grid. He says another issue is protecting wildlife.
The history of management of transition lines isn't some solid track record from an environmental conservation point of view. We could be doing a much better job in transmission corridors.
In these cases, decarbonization groups and conservationists are at odds with each other. Notably, a recent court ruling is allowing a transmission line project involving Wisconsin to advance. Heidla says non-wire alternatives are emerging to help the movement without turning to the grid. In Minnesota, Xcel Energy has been testing a program that incentivizes customers to curb energy use during peak demand. Similar programs are taking shape elsewhere, but industry analysts say these initiatives are navigating their own barriers as they try to get off the ground. Still, Heidla says an example of this approach along the East Coast is turning some heads.
It's a BYOB program, bring your own battery program, that now over 24,000 customers in 3 eastern states have subscribed to. It's basically a subsidy to put a battery in your house and just to make sure that you're not using electricity during peak times.
As governments, utilities, and other entities face pressure to meet climate goals amid soaring demand for electricity, Heidla suggests these solutions will have to work hand in hand. His group is focused on efficiencies, such as rooftop solar, to reshape the distribution of energy. But he says large-scale renewable energy projects play a role too, including the economic benefits for communities in which they're located. This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection.
Shade trees are increasingly important as our climate gets warmer. Urban areas with trees can be as much as 15 degrees cooler than areas with less foliage. Dr. Anthony Lisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. If you go to a city park on a hot summer day, you might sit under a big shady tree to cool off. But that tree is helping you beat the heat even when you're not standing directly under it. One study found that on very hot days, greener areas of Baltimore and Washington, D.C. can be more than 15 degrees cooler than areas of those same cities with fewer trees. And research from the nonprofit American Forests has found similar patterns in cities as diverse as Las Vegas, Minneapolis, Denver, and Atlanta. One reason for this dramatic difference in temperatures is that dark-colored roads and rooftops get scorchingly hot when the sun shines down on them. Then those surfaces release the heat they've absorbed back into the surrounding air. By shading streets and buildings, trees help keep those surfaces from getting so warm. They also help cool the air around them by taking water out of the ground and releasing it through their leaves as water vapor, a process called transpiration. So shade trees are a pretty cool way to fight urban heat. And by planting them in areas with little tree cover, cities can help ensure that all residents can find relief as the climate warms. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 13th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moss. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Mike Moan, Suzanne Potter, Jill Freitas, Catherine Carley, Terry D., and Dr. Anthony Lysowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ezra.
And I'm Nina Mayfair. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you could go to bit.ly/KBOO or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Labor Radio.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO News in